One of the best-known faces in America is on the cover of a new book, but you might not immediately recognize that face. It's a photograph of an 11 or 12-year-old boy wearing the red-rimmed uniform of one of two teams in his South Dakota town, the Pickstown Pheasants. The boy's cap is perched back over a cowlick. He's smiling at the camera. During a summer in which he played baseball by day, swam in the river during the afternoon, and flirted with the high school girls who served him and his friends Coca-Cola floats and double-dip ice cream cones before the sunset on the hot prairie. As Tom Brokaw notes in his memoir, A Long Way From Home, he was one of the first members of his family who didn't work with his hands for a living. South Dakota was the home he wanted to leave for the larger world that would put his own name in bright lights, but it is also a place from which he's grateful to be, and to which he's grateful to return, as he has in this memoir. Tom Brokaw now joins us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Tom, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
You write about taking a trip back to South Dakota in, I guess it's 1996, with your mother, who I think we can fairly say also your own best critic.
Yes.
What was that trip like?
Oh, it was a wonderful time for the two of us to be together. Her firstborn, we shared so many interests. And we went back to the northern prairie and found the small farm in which she began life, really. And then the farm was lost to the cruelties of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. The town in which she met my father, and they began their life. It's all still there, but it's faded several generations now, I suppose. And it gave me a strong sense of how much they had gone through to give me the life that I have, and how much change she had been witness to. Mm-hmm. But how centered she was as she withstood all of that change and kept moving forward in her own life, and was very keenly aware of what was going on in the world and never whined and never whimpered about the hand that fate had dealt her.
How was it that Jackie Robinson, playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, became your sports hero?
My grandfather, really, who was the man who lost his farm, quite a populist man and a bookish man who followed sports less for the batting averages and for who won and for who lost, but then more for the larger stories. And when the Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson, he said, "We're going to be a Dodger fan. They've done the right thing here." And he was very proud of Branch Rickey and admired him for what he did. And so then the entire family really attached ourselves to Jackie Robinson, and he became the defining sports figure of my young life. I just lived and died by the Dodgers, and especially by his exploits. And when I began to realize that we may have been denied his great, great talents simply because of his pigmentation, it really kind of told me all I needed to know about racism.
I want to ask you about another figure, though, from your baseball past. Youngster your own age named Johnny Strutz, was that his name?
Yes. Yes, John Strutz. We had two teams one summer, the Pheasants, as you indicated, and the Warriors. I was a Pheasant. We were 11 and 12, and the Warriors were 13 and 14. And we had no, for some reason, organized supervision that summer, so we took it upon ourselves to have bake sales and car washes, raise money, buy uniforms, and then every day we would divide up and play at the local sandlot baseball in the morning, kind of open-ended games with no umpire. We'd manage the game for ourselves. But when there was a dispute, we'd turn to Johnny Strutz, who was a member of the gang, but he was a quiet, reserved, studious boy who did not play, and he would make the declaration, "You're out. I know you were safe at home." And we would trust his judgment. That next winter, he developed leukemia and died, and it was our first experience for all of us with death in our midst. And it was a painful, painful time. And in the spring of the following year, there was a practice field just across from his home, and it was kind of a leader of our gang by the name of Chuck Gremmels, who was always organizing things. And he got the Pheasants and the Warriors together, and he lined the Pheasants down the first baseline and the Warriors down the third baseline, and he stood at the pitcher's mound, and we took off our hats and held them over our hearts. And Chuck Gremmels said, "This will be known as Strutz Field forever." When I was asked by the Hall of Fame to write an account of my memories of baseball for their permanent archives, I thought about, I was at Yankee Stadium the night that Reggie hit three out against the Dodgers. I was here in Dodger Stadium the night.
Reggie, I'm afraid for our audience, Tom, we have to specify it's Reggie Jackson.
Reggie Jackson, that's right. And
you know that NPR audience.
Right. Yeah. And Kirk Gibson. I was in Dodger Stadium the night that Kirk Gibson hit it out against the A's, used to see Sandy Koufax. But I thought about all of those And then I realized that the real defining baseball experience for me was Johnny Strutz and Strutz Field Forever. And when I go back to that small town, which is pretty well closed up now, I always try to drive past that patch of prairie grass.
When did you first understand you had a powerful voice and manner?
Well, I don't think it was a eureka moment. I always like to talk, and the first experience that I can remember, which I describe as I was, I think, 4 years old, living on an Army base, and it was the holiday season, and they had a big Christmas pageant, and my father stood way at the back of a room crowded with uniformed Army personnel, and it was smoky, and I could still see the silver bunting, and I opened the program by saying, "They said I was too young to speak a piece tonight." And if my father could hear me at the back of the room, he was holding up a silver dollar, I would get the silver dollar. And then I was called on after that in class and other places to, you know, to preside or to do dramatic readings. I love the idea of entertaining people, and I had this great curiosity about what was going on in the world. So that led me naturally to radio when I was just 15, living in Yankton, where we had a 250-watt radio station, and they needed help in the evening, and I was quick to volunteer.
Mm-hmm. Can you still do your rock and roll DJ voice?
You know, I don't know whether I can.
We don't want to put you on the spot. Yeah.
Well, I guess what we would do.
I know you usually don't get. Go ahead.
Mounds of Sound, Saxawax, KYNT 1450 coming your way for the next half hour with all the latest music. I'm Terrible Tom.
They're all putting thumbs up. So when did you begin to get an indication that other people could? Could be moved by your words, hang on them, take something from them?
Gee, that's a good question. It wasn't that I was just enamored by the sound of my own voice, but I did notice that if I got up in front of a classroom or if I were on the radio, I could generally command an audience and I had a certain facility for describing what was going on. One of the real seminal moments in my life was at that little radio station. In 1956, it was election night, and I was down volunteering for it, and I was sent out to a rural precinct to collect the votes, and they decided to have their covered dish dinner before they turned over the votes, and I raced back to the station. Eisenhower was winning nationally, obviously, and I thought, boy, this is pretty terrific. And it was about that time that Huntley and Brinkley were coming on the air, and I would watch in awe the early correspondence of John Chancellor and Sander Van Oker, and thought, my God, to be one of them and to travel the world and have someone else pay for it. And I thought, if I continue to work at this, maybe there could be a place for me.
Tom, thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott.
Tom Brokaw. His new book, A Long Way From Home, Growing Up in the American Heartland. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.